From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzek Rilat, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. Today marks 18 years since the 1995 bombing of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building. Hundreds gathered downtown this morning to mark the occasion at the Oklahoma City National Memorial and Museum.
Our mission is far from complete. There is no more graphic reminder of that than the smoke rising from the finish line in Boston. It is crucial that we continue what we started here 18 years ago.
Our guest today designed the outdoor symbolic portion of the memorial in 1997 with German colleagues.
For them, it was just too literal. When we got to the U.S., it was way too abstract.
We'll talk with Oklahoma City architect Hans Bootzer about remembering tragedy through architecture. But first, this hour's news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzek Rilat. Yesterday, mourners gathered in the Cathedral of the Holy Cross in Boston's South End to remember the victims of Monday's bombings at the Boston Marathon. Here's Boston Mayor Tom Menino.
It gives us strength to say goodbye to the young boy with a big heart, Martin Richard. We pray for his sister and his mom, his brother and his dad. It helps us to say that we'll miss Crystal Campbell and celebrate a spirit that brought her to the marathon year after year. It prepares us to mourn Lingzhi's Lu, who came to the city in search of an education but found new friends. I'll never forget her. I'm telling you, nothing can defeat the heart of the city. Nothing. Nothing will take us down because we take care of one another.
This morning, family members, friends, and survivors gathered in downtown Oklahoma City to mark our April tragedy, the 1995 bombing of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building. President Clinton dedicated the Oklahoma City National Memorial and Museum at the former site of the federal building on the fifth anniversary of the bombing in 2000. He spoke about walking through the memorial's field of empty chairs when he accepted the Oklahoma City National Memorial Foundation's 2010 Reflections of Hope Award.
I went back to the memorial, and just by myself, I just went back and I took some flowers, and I had never laid any flowers on the chair of Al Witcher, who was on my personal presidential security detail before he came here, because he and his wife thought this would be the finest place in America to raise their children. And so I did it. And the gentleman, yeah, you can clap for yourselves on that. And so I was intent on finding this chair. And I got some help from the gentleman who was there, and he talked to me about the last time I was there and the other agent whom I'd laid a wreath at her chair. And we talked about what had happened to her family. And then I just turned around, and I almost didn't recognize the tree. I thought the tree had had plastic surgery. I've reached the age where about every third living thing I pass has had plastic surgery. And so, I mean, it was so full and so beautiful. And it's a metaphor for all of you.
Oklahoma City architect Hans Bootzer and his wife Tori designed the memorial with their colleague Sven Berg while living in Berlin in 1997. Bootzer is now a professor of architecture at the University of Oklahoma. And one of his design partnership's most recent projects is the Skydance Bridge over Interstate 40. Hans Bootzer, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you very much.
Well, you're an architect. You live here in Oklahoma City and are famously known for some of the work that you've done, in particular the Oklahoma City Memorial. But can you start by telling us a little bit about kind of what drew you to be an architect, and how is our interest in architecture international in nature? I mean, people travel the world to see different forms of architecture. So what is it about architecture that kind of draws us to view it in different settings around the world?
Well, I was very fortunate to grow up kind of split between the Chicago area and Western Germany. You know, our parents are native Germans who moved to the U.S. in 59. So we, you know, having a strong family relationship, spent about a third of our summers in Germany. You know, my father would do his research in Africa or southern Europe. So he'd drop the kids off with the grandparents in Aachen. And then my grandparents and uncle would then take us on trips throughout northern Europe. And so that exposure kind of led me to the conclusion that there are, you know, some structures that have been around a long time, and it's quite beautiful how they shape cultures and give one a sense of anchoring and so forth. And so that, I think, started to develop in me this kind of sense of love for the legacy of architecture and interest in legacy architecture. And then you couple that with having, you know, spent a good part of my childhood in the Chicago area, where you have, you know, the birth of the skyscraper. You've got Frank Lloyd Wright's Robie House a couple blocks from my father's office at the University of Chicago. You know, I grew up 25 miles from Route 66, you know, just by Kankakee. And so, you know, all around me in that environment was, again, you know, architecture and, you know, a very American form of architecture. And so, you know, you start to combine those experiences and you start to realize that, you know, there are similarities, there are differences. And, you know, for me, there was no difference whether it was in Europe or the U.S. It seemed very fluid.
So how so? That it was fluid. I mean, because you just talked about kind of structures shaping culture and that connection between culture and structure. So how is it that it was all the same to you and that it was fluid?
Well, for start, you know, German is my first language, but I grew up in a house in the upper Midwest speaking German. And it was only as I got older that I realized that the kids around me didn't speak German. In fact, they all thought I was weird because I spoke German. And, you know, our moving back and forth between Germany and the U.S. every year, it just seemed like that was life. And, you know, you just did that. And the idea that, you know, my parents were going to go fly off to, you know, like I said, Africa or southern Europe and do their research, they'd go buy, you know, wood carvings or little alligators and bring them home. And so in my living room, we have these little wooden carved alligators or wooden masks on walls. You know, for me, that was normal. And so, you know, whenever my father would test us on world capitals, for example, when we were kids, it was just obvious that that was where we live. You know, it's the world in which we live, and that, you know, everywhere around me was this love of people, different viewpoints that different peoples have, and how can architecture, in my case, be a manifestation of those different viewpoints. And so for me, I never saw the distinction. It was very organic in the world in which I grew up.
I wonder, you say that it's very similar, but I wonder if there is a difference in how different cultures think about space and how the usage of space, be it for buildings, roads, parks, how that then also contributes to the extension of that culture and how you can see that in Europe, in the United States, and perhaps elsewhere.
Yeah. I think, you know, when you grow up with the idea that, well, of course there are different people with different viewpoints, and of course they have different ways of manifesting them and, mm-hmm. you know, cultural forms, you know, fixed or fluid, you kind of grow up naturally recognizing that anytime you speak with anyone, whether it's your neighbor or it's someone you encounter at the airport, they're going to be coming at things from their own viewpoint. And so for me, the charge in architecture, if we kind of zoom back out and look at what it is I practice every day, whether it's teaching or practicing, I feel very naturally predisposed to want to look into the individual's eyes and try and glean from them what their story is. And it may be something that's very localized, or it may be something that is, you know, much broader than that. And so in a certain sense, you could argue that every individual, especially more and more in this kind of globalized society, you know, the internet starts to break things down. You know, I keep telling my students, you don't have money to travel, just get on the internet. It's the window to the world. It's you know, it's the cheapest alternative. But, you know, you start to recognize that, you know, we all have our own cultures at a very micro scale. And it's just a question at some point of at what point you ratchet it up. And then you start to shift the subject into, okay, now you have certain common shared values about space, about architecture. For example, you know, do we like an architecture that's more literal or figurative, for example? You know, Americans, they get queasy with abstract architecture, you know, architecture that's kind of simplified. At least I think that's where it's been historically. I think that's starting to evolve a bit. Whereas the Germans, which is I know best in these experiences, prefer things that are a bit more abstract. You know, they'd rather not get too emotional. The memorial design, for example, You know, Tori and I designed that while we were in Germany. And so we kind of were developing it conceptually in a very blended environment. And when we showed our concept to our colleague Sven and his wife Christina, they kind of shirked a bit and thought, oh, chairs, that's like, ooh, that's way too literal. You know, that's we don't do that here in Germany. That's and in fact, the Frankfurt Allgemeine, which is, I think, the largest newspaper in Germany, wrote an editorial after our design was selected. And they said, they first of all erroneously assumed we were Germans and said, oh, how appropriate that this German team would pick chairs, which is just such a typical way for Germans to see themselves as these, you know, bureaucratic people that just sit around in chairs, that they would say that's a great memorial. But the larger point was simply that for them, it was just too literal. When we got to the U.S., it was way too abstract. And so that was very fascinating for Tori and I. And it was also almost an aspect of the project that we realized, you know, maybe this is just the right way to go, you know, because we are talking about it and we are finding ourselves kind of in this gap or this overlap zone. But I was just looking at a magazine yesterday at a car ad, right? We're selling cars in the U.S. now with really abstract, modern-looking architecture in the backdrop, right? Very futuristic. But something tells me that if we did a design here in Norman and we put that design in the middle of the downtown Oklahoma, Norman, I'm pretty sure there'd be an awful lot of people that get pretty upset. And yet at the same time, we're using that abstract architecture, kind of really sleek, you know, kind of gray tones, minimally detailed, to sell these things that we love. And yet we struggle at the same time to embrace them as part of our, you know, day-to-day identity. And so you start to see all these conditions that are ripe with contradiction, ripe with overlap, you know, ripe with opportunities to realize that, you know, more and more there's a blurring. And the idea of culture, I think, could even be argued to have a different definition as we move forward.
Our guest is Oklahoma City architect Hans Bützer, who's best known as a member of the architecture partnership that designed the Oklahoma City National Memorial. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. I'm Suzette Grelot, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews on KGOU. I'm Suzette Grelot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Our guest is Oklahoma City architect Hans Bützer. We're talking with him on the 18th anniversary of the bombing of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building. Bützer and his wife Tori designed the Oklahoma City National Memorial with their colleague Sven Berg while living in Berlin. Just before the break, Bützer described the cultural differences between Germany and the U.S. when it comes to memorializing tragedy. In your experience of, especially having, you know, been in Germany at the time when you designed this very important memorial and implementing this kind of, you know, across the continents, did you look at all about kind of across other countries and how memorials are received in general? I mean, that connection between kind of how each culture wants to memorialize things or how they memorialize things or that desire to memorialize in very different ways. So, for example, when you go to Northern Ireland and you go and you drive through Belfast and you find, you know, memorials that are very, very different in terms of kind of murals on walls and buildings that are memorializing those that have been lost in their conflict, their troubles there versus, you know, a very physical, you know, statue or some other type of memorial somewhere else. I mean, do you see real cultural differences in the ways in which we remember our past and celebrate it?
Very much so. You know, Tori and I have traveled a lot and also spent a lot of time with books. We're often asked, you know, do we look at other places for, you know, how did they do their memorials? And we didn't really do that, but I do believe that, you know, somewhere organically, intuitively, we've, you know, our the way we viewed the project was informed by these, you know, past experiences. And, you know, being in Berlin at the time, you know, we would take the S train to our office every day, and you'd go past the Museumsinsel, the museum island there in eastern Berlin, which is a fascinating place. It's almost like the island itself is a museum. You look at the old, you know, like the Bode Museum. It still has pockmarks from the shrapnel and so forth, from bombings, explosions, so forth, in World War II. You know, the average person there doesn't really notice them anymore, right? And so for us, that's kind of a clue that suggests, well, you know, there are certain tragedies that, you know, we may not feel the need to, you know, take a step back and kind of deliberately outline somewhere in public space, you know, this place of remembrance. There are other things that are just so ubiquitous that it feels, you know, odd to stop and pause. The idea for example, the Holocaust Memorial that was built by original design by Richard Serra and eventually with Peter Eisenman, you know, has gotten a lot of, you know, controversial feedback. There were so many people that felt like we didn't need to build it in Germany, that there was such a deep ingrained lesson the Germans had learned that had so overhauled their culture and the way they viewed themselves, the way they viewed their role as a military force or not in the world.
This was the Holocaust Memorial in Berlin,
yes,
that you're referring to.
Yes, but it's basically the German National Memorial.
Right.
There.
Which is, just try to describe that memorial, if you will, because it's such a striking thing. And in fact, for many, they don't even get it.
Exactly.
You know? I mean, which kind of leads to this issue of how memorials reflect a certain meaning, which again, you know, may not necessarily transcend borders, that,
right,
that the meaning itself is implicit. But so will you describe
So the German Holocaust Memorial is placed, you know, immediately south of the Brandenburg Gate, you know, basically right there on the threshold between what was East and West Berlin, very prominent location. All the German embassies, you know, 13 German states have their state embassy buildings right there. So you couldn't be more in a kind of like in the heart of German nationalism, if you will, and even German Hitler's bunkers a couple hundred yards away. But this memorial is really this vast field of roughly 2,500 concrete blocks. They almost look like tombstones, perhaps, you know, some would say caskets, very abstractly, minimally detailed. They're kind of like this dark gray, and they blend into the ground plane, this cobbled black dark granite. And the tops of these individual markers kind of are varied in height, so they kind of create this undulating landscape at a kind of abstract level. And I think the thought process there was very much the idea that, you know, while yes, we need to, you know, pause and carve out a place literally to remember this tragedy and recognize, you know, in this case, the Germans' complicity in it, and then also try to develop something that invokes a magnitude that borders on beyond comprehension, but then to treat it as a topography and suggest that it almost becomes a part of our national identity, national landscape. But then you balance that out with the interesting reality that, well, Germans, I think, are historically accustomed to something more abstract. Shockingly, this memorial is too abstract. And so you now have, you know, kids just like, you know, hopscotching
That's
around
right.
all
just
over.
People playing around there, sitting on it.
Skateboarders, bicyclists, mm-hmm. and so forth. And so suddenly what was supposed to be hallowed ground is you know, almost becoming a caricature of something that can go wrong on a grand scale. And so that kind of starts to invite that, you know, question of universality and is there a universality in the typology of a memorial, for example. And, you know, you might be able to make the argument at certain times that within cultures there is a typology or a trend, but across cultures maybe less so. But, you know, this case in particular undermines the idea that even within Germany you might agree on something. And it may just be that, you know, the Holocaust Memorial and the murder of 6 million Jews is such an intense moment in German history that, you know, you still run into people, you know, especially, you know, much older who are still angry about the fact that the Germans should feel guilty about it. I mean, you're floored that still exists. So, you know, you see that example and then suddenly you have a young generation that starts to feel – it's not that they don't care, but it's almost like they feel a little bit like they're now paying for the sins of two generations past. So they almost don't want to hear about it anymore. And so it's kind of this, you know, very fascinating conversation that, you know, when you get all these generations together – it will result in, as we see, in some sort of debate, confusion.
Difficulty translating not only across cultures but across generations.
Yes,
for sure.
Very much so.
So very quickly then, because we have a little time left, is there such a thing as good or bad architecture? And what I mean by that is the intention of the architect or the intention of the designer and how it's received by the recipient, the person viewing the memorial or the structure, whatever it may be. Is there a right way? I guess not. So not good or bad, but right or wrong way to see a structure such as this and to appreciate its form, like kind of like art, I guess. You know, when you build something, when you create a piece of art, the artist had perhaps some sort of intention, and yet that may not be the message. And I guess so related to the memorial in Berlin, that it was intended to evoke a certain kind of response, and it really didn't or hasn't for many. So what? So kind of as a last word here, how would you rate that phenomenon of kind of relationship between the architect, the structure, and the recipient or the viewer?
I think your question is impossible to answer in one word, just to be clear.
Okay, Tim.
But ultimately, you know, the architect has to represent at least two, if not three, points of view. You know, one is the architect has to admit or embrace the reality that, you know, normal people, you know, non-architects, and architects can be an odd bunch because of the way we view the world. But we have to embrace the reality that normal people will be the predominant users of our work. And so we have an obligation, ethical obligation, I believe, to be working at a level that when we design it, that, you know, that normal people, and I say that as a compliment, by the way.
normal people being the untrained eye, those of us who don't know any better.
Right, okay. Those that haven't been messed up in arca-speak. everyone has to be able to find a level in which they can embrace the work. You know, you're on dangerous ground if you design something that it's so abstract that nowhere in the project is there really a foothold for people to kind of begin engaging. You know, I always explain to the students, you know, architecture should be viewed as something where you need to start at a place where everyone can kind of gather on, you know, and it's kind of like architecture needs to reach out its hand and reach it out and let someone take its hand, and you start a walk, and you start from a place of familiar, and you then start to wander into, you know, a world where, you know, it's architecture as function, it's as beauty, it's as, you know, a mode of investment and function. So it's, you know, you have to find and establish a commonplace, but then the architecture does have an obligation to future generations to move beyond the immediate and to try and tap into certain things that are perhaps a bit more timeless, a bit more abstract, and that could be perhaps embraced by other generations, other cultures, other users. You know, in some ways it's a very sustainable, you could argue, way of looking at things, that everyone has a way to plug in and experience the architecture for something that has integrity and good intent.
Well, thank you so much, Hans Bützer, for being with us today on World Peace.
Thank you very much. Enjoyed it.
You've been listening to our conversation with Hans Bützer, a University of Oklahoma architecture professor and one of the designers of the Oklahoma City National Memorial. We'd love to hear your thoughts about this program. Send us a tweet at WorldViewsKGOU or leave us a comment on KGOU's Facebook page or website at kgou.org. WorldViews is a collaborative partnership between OU's College of International Studies and KGOU Radio. Mackenzie Samus prepared the research for this interview, and the program is produced by Brian Hardzinski. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Grelott.